Hi, Kelvin.
Hi, Ole.
Kelvin, we are doing this fascinating series of conversations in which you explain what you have discovered in tetrionics. And for today, I'd like to explore something which is very tricky in a way, which is gravity and also the idea of black holes. And I asked you to go into this for the simple reason that when you were exploring tetrionics, you discovered that you needed to actually think about it in a totally different manner. Gravity became a different notion, and black holes actually became not necessary. As you formulated, there is a lot of assumptions that were necessary to bring science to where we are now. But from the perspective of tetrionics, with the grammar that it provides, actually it is possible to see what was an assumption and where it is in fact no longer needed. So I was hoping that you would be able to explain how you got into this different understanding of gravity, where gravity is different than textbooks at the moment describe it, plus also why you have no need for the notion of black holes. Perhaps we could just start with a general overview of what you were looking at and what you found before we go into the details of how others can come to that understanding also.
For sure. As I discussed, it's the gravity side of things is something that everyone chases. The idea of finally explaining what gravity is, how its mechanics work, and of course, in doing that, you have to explain quantum gravity as well as cosmological or large scale gravity that we observe. It's one of the sticking blocks of physics, and a lot of people start their physics careers with this in mind. If they can crack the problem of gravity and explain it, that will reveal a whole lot of other things about the universe and get things on its way, which is why we've got a lot of effort being put into search for gravity waves, frame B experiments, a lot of people working specifically on general relativity, and despite the fact that we still use Newtonian gravitational formulas in a lot of places, the explorations there and the intense interest is there is because gravity as such is a bit of an enigma in itself. We've got two different ways of describing the force. Both ways of describing it are equally valid, one more to the than the other. One has a time component, the other one does not. One describes it as a force, the other one says there is no force, it's following the curvature of space-time. So we're left with this conundrum where two formulas describe it, both describe the mechanics as wildly varying, and then we've got another fly in the ointment, so to speak, which is the quantum mechanics developed by Planck and Bohr and others, Schrodinger, which must obviously play a role at the smaller scales, and yet it's never been fully integrated into relativistic theories because it produces infinities and gives us things like black holes and white holes and time warps and wormholes through the galaxy. I must point out, as you've said, Otto, tetrionics, after much grinding and headaches and sleepless nights, the geometry of tetrionics finally resolved the problem, and the resolution was quite simple. They don't exist. When you extrapolate and follow the field geometries and the mechanics that I'm about to explain, you'll see that black holes come about purely because mathematicians are trying to go past the point of singularity where the electric and magnetic fields meet and gravitational fields converge. They get to this point, and the question is, what if the force was such that it would there's something went past this point? Mathematically, you can go past the point. Geometrically, the point is just a meeting of fields, and that geometry replicates like fractals do. Smaller and smaller, you still have the same geometry. So you can't go past that point to create a black hole. And all that will be explained in the probably what will be a second series of these talks. They'll be more than likely spread out over two parts, because I'm aware that some people will dive straight into this discussion first up, thinking, well, we'll dive in and we'll understand gravity. We'll see what his explanation of gravity is, at least, with the illustrations, and follow what he's saying to consider it ourselves. And that's what science is about. Open your mind, see what people say, see if one theory makes more sense than another theory that's in use. Can we test it? Can we validate it? Can we improve upon it? And if so, should we accept it? So I hope that everyone that's tuning in can be patient for probably a two-part discussion, because if you're diving in at this stage, you're probably not familiar with tetrionics as it applies to quantum mechanics, QED, which is electrical theory, and chemistry, which deals with particularly matter topologies and how they come together through their forces. And they're all key components, because tetrionics wasn't developed at the top end, as I said at the beginning of this preamble. I didn't look for a solution for gravity in order to make tetrionics. Tetrionics is built from the ground up, not the top down. And what happened, in all honesty, was I developed quantum mechanics first, started on quantum chemistry, did QED, finished quantum chemistry, and then, and only then, tackled quantum cosmology and eventually math. It was fortuitous for me that I did it in that order, because it allowed me to follow the geometry. Had I used the equilateral geometries and the topologies that I'd roughly worked out to try and solve gravity first, I have no doubt this process would have taken many, many more years. But because I started from the ground up and said, what can we build with these triangles of energy? What forces does it give us? What particles? What fields? How do they interact? And solved dozens of little, seemingly unconnected problems in physics, I wouldn't have come across and developed the coherent theory that you see before you now. So that's all I'll say about that. If you have a chance and you've got the time, by all means, I recommend starting at the earlier books and working through before you dive in here. But nevertheless, I'll keep this at a high level of approach so that people can still absorb what's going on. But if you want more detail, it's there in the illustrations. And if you read the books, you'll find yourself getting more and more understanding of what I'm talking about as we go. So to kick it off, the first illustration, I'll just follow.
Can I just interject here? Because something a lot of people will find difficult to understand, and which for you it's become so very logical already, is that we actually need to take account of the differences in philosophy which were used in classical theory, which basically looked at matter, then the theory of relativity, which is basically, let's call it chemical, and then quantum theory, which regards the particular electromagnetic, electrodynamic of atoms. Now we need to go beyond that. We need to see how it all hangs together in what's called the unified theory. A lot of people are confused because they learn about gravity in high school, and they get that surrounded by a classical perspective of Newton. I know we'll get around to that, but I'm asking a kind of a preamble overview on this, because so many people associate gravity with the material, and they forget that the theory of relativity and the chemical molecular dynamics are already understood, which Newton didn't have at that time. So we actually need to go beyond that as well in quantum theory, which is an electromagnetic perspective on protons and electrons and all that and atoms. And people tend to forget that as well when they hear the word gravity. So Calvin, could you give just a few words on shifting that perspective from the material, mechanical, Newtonian physical interpretation of gravity as it is still in the school books, to connect it up with this understanding of quantum theory, which is basically a universal electromagnetic field interaction dynamic, because that is where we now need to give gravity a place. So it's like in a theater play, we see the same actor, gravity, but the landscape around it has changed from the one scene to the next, in going from classical theory to quantum theory. So for many people who still believe that gravity is something which we can understand in a very classical sense, I would like to help them have a kind of understanding that no, the scenes in the theater play have already shifted fundamentally. We can no longer look at it in that sense.
I'll extend your analogy a bit further from the stage, mm-hmm. and ask you to think about it this way, in terms of a puppeteer play with full life-size puppets. Most people are familiar with them, with the full-grown actors holding sticks and manipulating the puppet. The actors are usually dressed in black, so that when the stage is set and lit, you tend to see one large puppet moving around and interacting with other puppets, oblivious of the people doing all the motions underneath. And that's a lot like what gravitation, universal gravitation, as described by Tetrionics, is about. The first illustration of the series in my gravitation book, or cosmology book, 6101, sets the stage, if you like. It shows that under tetrionic theory, we not only have our classical understanding of quantum and classical Newtonian mechanics, but we also have our electromagnetic dynamics, the electrical theory, and we have Einstein's theories of special and general relativity. All these things, all these people, their formulas, their ideas, are all actors present on the same stage. Think of gravity, if you like, as the main puppet. From a distance, without looking closely at it, we see the large puppets interacting and we enjoy the show. That is what I would call universal gravitation. At a first glance, as Newton did, he looked at the motions of the planets, where gravity's most readily seen and observed, the forces that are moving on, that are causing accelerations and motion of bodies towards each other. He then modeled the forces between planets of mass matter to give us these models of acceleration that he then called the inverse force of gravity, which is always convergent. So that you could consider to be the main player. That's what everyone can readily see and observe. When you look closer, obviously, you can see the puppeteers, and you can be distracted by the puppeteers. And I put that as an analogy for what happened when Einstein came along to correct Newtonian ideas of gravity by observing a bit closer the motions of the planets and finding out that they didn't quite follow what was going on and what was being mathematically modeled. They didn't match at a fine degree. For most cases, everyday usage, Newtonian laws and gravitational formula work fine. They still use them to send rockets to the moon and out to the planets. It's only in extreme examples that it gets that there becomes an issue with it that needs to be rectified. And that's what Einstein did. And he did it by extending special relativity. Special relativity was out in 1905. He had great success with it, explaining how starlight was bent around the sun and other objects like that, correcting different things. But he still had a problem with it. He had to explain, well, he wanted to explain the perihelion of Mercury in particular. And with the bending of starlight and the perihelion, he had to combine them in such a way as to expose a mechanics that Newton would not have been aware of. So he extended special relativity and gave us general relativity. It's a completely different way. Newton said there was a force, which he openly admitted in his books he could not explain. He had no explanation for what this force was, how it worked, or even why it was there, anything to do with the mechanics. He had no explanation. But he had a mathematical formula that gave the right results based on the observations. Einstein came along and said, well, based on things like Lorentz contractions and mass E equals mc squared from special relativity and other ideas I have like curved space-time, I'll develop this mathematical model called general relativity. Now, here's where I'll probably rub a few people the wrong way, but in a very brief assessment, Einstein knew the answer he was chasing. He knew from observations the difference between the observed motion of Mercury around the Sun compared to where Newton's formula said it should be. So he knew he had to get a correction factor. And in a very blunt sense, what he did was he developed a mathematical model that gave him that answer. It's very easy to develop mathematical models when you know the answer you're looking for, and QED is another example and another discussion. But he amended special relativity to give him general relativity, which gave him the answer he sought to match the observations. So in some senses, Einstein's highly vaunted general relativity is simply another version of Newton, albeit in a different age, sitting down to develop a formula that models the motion of the planets. Einstein's observations were simply more accurate than Newton's. He approached it in a different way because of his theories of relativity, and he came up with general relativity. And that left us with two distinctly different types of formulations for gravity. Now, while all this was happening, as you'll see from that illustration, we had the discovery from Faraday of invisible lines of magnetic force, electric and magnetic, which Maxwell combined or unified into a electromagnetic field of force or fields of force. And then just as special relativity was being developed, Michelson and Morley went out to measure the speed of light with regard to the ether that was said to exist, that the photon had to oscillate or had to make oscillate in order to travel. So they went out to measure it and they couldn't find it. The only explanation that could account for that null effect at the time was developed by Lorentz and Abraham. They developed what are called Lorentz contractions. And the contractions simply say the faster an object's going, the more it's contracted or shortened. And that gives us these null results that we were expecting, where we were expecting positive results for motion in certain directions. Now, Tetrionics had to take all of this into account. And that's why I said earlier that it's really best to start at QM and do QED before jumping straight into gravity, because those three books have a large impact. The secret to gravity, which has to, not only do you have to make a universal, unified theory of gravity, I had to explain Newton's results and his formulation. I had to explain Coulomb's and Maxwell's and Faraday's and Gauss's results using electric and magnetic fields, along with the Lorentz contractions, because they are all implicit within special relativity. And I had to explain, and the model, not only just explain, but the model of tetrionic universal gravity also has to match general relativity. It quickly became apparent as I developed the theories that what we were dealing with here was human observers looking at the large-scale forces and motions, be it the motions of planets or the accelerational forces between the planets, or a depiction of those forces as a ball rolling down an incline in a curved space-time. We had those two scenes that were set by different observers, but in amongst there, what the observers didn't observe were these immaterial fields of Faraday, Gauss, Maxwell, Lorentz. They were still in play. So even though Newton, working with the knowledge and the technology at his time, formulated the laws, they apply beautifully because he modeled mathematically the motions. Einstein came along and corrected for an inefficiency using a new formulation of motion, relativity, and gave us general relativity to explain gravity. But at the same time, what you'll see in tetrionics, as we unify those two disparate theories of gravitation with Planck's quantum mechanics and the invisible fields of force between all forms of matter, you'll see that there's an interplay of not one force of gravity, but three forces. And there's the convergent gravity force, as I call it, which is created by matter. And then in addition to that, there's an electromagnetic force, which, just as Coulomb described in his law of attraction, attracts as well as repels. That works within these invisible fields that we can't see. But they all combine the interactions and the convergent force of gravity to give us a single observable motion of bodies of matter, or bodies of mass matter, more correctly. And that's what tetrionics, what I'm about to dive in and try and explain, because it's really important to understand how tetrionics models the models and explains the existing form theories of gravity, what the role of space and time is with relation to gravity, how the ether or vacuum energies play a role, and how the quantum level energies with their energy momenta, quantum Planck quanta, act in such a way to form matter, and the mass energy between them acts in such a way between the matter to create this universal force. It's a multi-layered cake in itself, but it's all easily represented and easily guided through. But there will be some high-level topics that you may need to go back to the older books and get your head around some of the discussions. But it really is just like a puppeteer's play. You have the large-scale puppets. Think of them as matter moving about on the stage. What's unseen are the puppeteers underneath making those movements, bringing them closer and pushing them apart, orchestrating their movements. To a first-time observer of the play, they're more enthralled with the puppets. But a fourth or fifth-time observer will begin to study the motions of the puppeteers themselves. And it's when you study the motions of the things that are hitherto invisible or unknown, as the case is with modern physics, that we start to see the real mechanics at work, what's really going on with what we call universal gravitation.
It's an excellent way to put the perspective that we need to shift the focus from the material that is seen to the forces that in fact create what we can see. And you have already now summarized that when you look at gravity from the perspective of tetrionics, that there is a physical part, there is an electromagnetic part, but the combined effect needs to be regarded separately as well. In tetrionics, you have this explicit distinction between matter, mass, and energy. Can you give a brief introduction on how important that distinction is in order to be able to put the view on gravity in that new perspective?
Yeah, I can. We'll probably end up making this preamble a whole discussion, and we'll touch on it again as we work through the theory and how it fits together. Yeah, but in essence, as tetrionics goes, obviously energy or equilateral energy is the cornerstone, the foundation block of everything in the universe. Now, that includes mass, that includes matter, and that includes all the forces of motion as well that we see, which makes up physics in general. In a nutshell, equilateral Planck quanta have energy and momentum. They can create a force, a linear force. They can have electric and magnetic fields, which they generate through charge, or we call charge. But they are a planar equilateral geometry. And I'll keep using that word as we progress through this study, because the definition between mass geometries and matter topologies is important. With the mass energy geometries, we can obviously form tetrahedral standing waves, waves of energy momenta that don't actually move. They're like those little models you see every day in the textbooks of the atoms spinning around with the electrons going very, very fast, but not actually moving in any sense. They're just all the motions in one point at space and time. That's what happens when you have four or more quanta of equilateral Planck mass energies fold up to become a tetrahedra, or a tetrion, as I call it. The tetrions obviously come together. They form larger and larger blocks of 3D matter. Now, the standing waves I call matter. Typically, I call mass energy radiant, or planar, Euclidean. The 3D matter is unique because it has a volume. It creates a closed volume. And because of that, it takes up a Z component in space. And it has a four energy momenta without actually moving. And in that sense, because it has this Z component and it's taking up a volume, I say matter has a topology. It has a surface. There's still a surface area with radiant mass energies, but the topology I speak of is the outer shell that's formed by mass energies as they create tetrions or leptons, any form of matter at any size. Because we're talking about gravity, obviously we start to talk of all these tetrions piling up to form planets and stars in most cases. And this is at the top end, the cosmological end of tetrionic theory, as opposed to the quantum foundations. What's important to understand is tetrionics rigidly, through geometry, differentiates between mass and matter. They are different things and they have different properties. They produce different things because of the difference between geometry and topology. That when you say geometry and topology, you're virtually saying mass and matter. Physics at this stage, what we call modern physics or contemporary physics, has no real definition or no way of differentiating between mass and matter, even as they speak the words in sentences. Physicists, modern physicists, will mix up the real terms of mass and matter, which tetrionics just simply says if it's a flat equilateral or a flat Euclidean sheet of paper that is energy, that is a geometry. It has no Z component. If it has a volume and it's made up of four or more equilateral geometries, which are all charged, and that's what the charge numbers in tetrionics are for, to differentiate the sizes, it has a topology. So tetrionics says we have mass geometries, or mass energy geometries, and matter topologies, whereas modern physics lumps it all together, and in relativity, it goes to the extent of calling everything energy, converting it from one form to the other so it's all energy, and then describing it as a pressure gradient or an energy density. this is where relativity went wrong in one of the many spots, and that's where Tetrionics has a number of corrections for it. But right through this discussion, you'll hear me talk about mass energy geometries, matter topologies. The mass energy geometries are important because they are the things that obviously give mass to matter. They are the things that, more importantly, radiate from matter topologies, and they create fields of force around matter that can either attract or repel, or when two particles come together, their fields of force overlap and they create other forces in between them. That's what I call a charge interaction. That's relatively well described, no pun intended, by relativity. What isn't described well by relativity is what physical forces and consequences are created by matter topologies. When you create a matter topology, the formation of the tetrion or any size particle will, by its very definition, displace a volume of the surrounding spatial region. Bear in mind that spatial region is filled with vacuum energies. When the matter is created, the topology is born, a certain area or a certain volume, more precisely, of that region is displaced. And that displacement creates a force. And that force is the vacuum energy senses that inside that matter topology, there's less energy, so it seeks to equalize it. And if you can mentally picture that, you can now mentally picture what's going on with gravity. Matter creates a gravity field, not a gravitational, a gravity field, purely by its topological displacement of vacuum energies. Exactly the same as putting a deflated rubber balloon in a pool. You can move it around, you don't feel a great deal of force, there's a little bit there. But it's a different story when you inflate that balloon and the ball blows up, its volume is created, it displaces water, then the pool will start pushing back on that balloon from all directions. That's what we're talking about with matter. There are distinct and very profound differences between mass energy that creates force and matter that just creates a pure gravity field. When you look at the universe in terms of mass, energy, and matter, where we have standing matter topologies, standing waves of mass energy, and around them we have a sphere, or a radiant sphere, I should say, of mass energy radiating out from that, be it motion or be it just a EM temperature field, whatever, all matter will radiate energy. You then have a gravity field created by the matter topology on which is superimposed a EM field of interaction. And if you think of matter as the big puppet and the EM fields as the puppeteers, that's what's going on. In the case of universal gravitation, you have matter creating a convergent gravity field, as well as its EM fields creating interactive, which are convergent and divergent fields, depending on their charges, of interaction. And those interactions can cause other particles to move toward or away from a form of matter. But irrespective, when you look at the convergent gravity and add the interactive EM field forces, you find that they cancel out. You have more convergent than you have divergent. So therefore, you end up on the large scale of planets and stars of a strictly convergent force. So you have three forces that are present, but the way they cancel each other self out in just vector addition, simple high school math, the three vector forces create one convergent force, and that's what Newton modeled. he saw that it was matter was always attracting, but it wasn't so much the gravity field that was causing the attraction. There's also this electromagnetic field. And again, when Einstein went to develop general relativity, he based it on the same ideas as Newton, that matter is strictly convergent. What causes this motion in order to bring about this exact result that I need to explain Mercury's motion? And he modeled his as a energy density pressure gradient using stress energies, and in doing so developed this rubber sheet model whose motions obviously gave him the predictions he wanted. He adjusted the formula so that at a long distance it is the same as Newton's, but close into stars it was 8 pi in order to account for twice the strength, if you like, to account for Newton's, or for the perihelion Mercury shift, or Mercury's perihelion, I should have said, compared to what Newton said it should have been, and for the bending of light and things like that. His amount was twice that of Newton's. What brings about this doubling, if you like? Simply, what brings it about is that closer to a star, closer to a planet, you have stronger and stronger electromagnetic fields. In the case of the Sun, the electromagnetic fields are the actual star. But all of these electromagnetic fields, whether you can see them in the form of the Sun's corona or you can't see them in the form of the Earth's electromagnetic field, make no difference. They are still an electromagnetic medium that electromagnetic fields are moving through. And there's a whole discussion again, which we'll get into as we go through the gravity overview, where by lumping together everything as energy, Einstein missed out on the greatest breakthrough of his entire history. And that breakthrough would have been mass energy matter and its geometry, as tetrionics shows. Had he realized that, he would have known that starlight wasn't being bent by the gravity field of the Sun. It was being refracted by the electromagnetic component or environment of the Sun. He would have realized that the same thing was happening to the within the gravitational field of the Earth. It's a gravito-electromagnetic field, which I call GEM fields. It's a combination of all three, and again, they're still being bent by moving through the Earth's electromagnetic field. All the claims of validating GR through GPS signal bouncing up and down are completely wrong. They confirm the Lorentz transformation, which applies to the electromagnetic portion of the forces we're talking about. Special relativity still applies to a photon of mass energy moving in an electromagnetic field. But that photon of electromagnetic energy is in no way affected by gravity. Gravity only works where you have a topology. So if you had, and again, here's the words of English fouling up the math of physics to produce poor descriptions. You don't have a particle of mass energy called a photon. You have a flat geometry. Two triangles, a diamond shape geometry is a photon. It has energy, momenta, it has mass, it is not a massless particle. It is in fact a weightless, matterless geometry. There is no matter because there is no topology. Because there is no matter and no topology, it cannot be affected by a pure gravity field. It can only be affected by electromagnetic fields. It can be bent, refracted, reflected, all those sorts of things. But because Einstein dealt in purely in terms of energy densities, because Newton dealt purely in terms of observed motions, their formulations reflect that. whereas Tetrionics builds from the ground up and says there's, if you have a quanta of matter, a tetrion or larger, you create a type of convergent gravity, a force. That's what we call gravity. Well, that's what I call gravity. In addition to that, we have electromagnetic fields around that gravity, around that matter particle, and those electromagnetic fields contribute forces to that particle of matter, and that's what we call gravitation. It's a threefold force, three vector force, of differing amounts depending on how big the body is, how much mass matter it has, how much mass energy in its EM field it has, its rotation, all these things play on it. But Tetrionics takes all that apart and models the motions, the forces, explains the corrections, explains how it matches Newton's observations and formulation, how it relates to Coulomb's work, how we can integrate Planck quanta into the understanding in order to give us special relativity as it relates to mass energy, and general relativity as it relates to gravitation. In turn, all those formulations and blending, we end up with a unified relativistic or fully relativistic quantum theory of gravity. So all these things, just like a cake, all these things have to come together. All that understanding and groundwork has to come together in order to understand exactly what Tetrionics is saying about gravitation and how it works.
Calvin, this is probably an ideal moment to make a brief interruption so that we can maintain the quality of the recording, because basically you have already given the overall perspective of how in Tetrionics gravity was the discovery from a bottom-up approach. You were not looking for gravity, but it basically came out of the whole understanding of the way forces create matter. Then we can now basically step through what you have found so that everybody can listen in and come to understand what you have already described in your books on the topic. So let me just end this recording for now so that we can keep the quality of it and immediately come back to you for the story after this nice, crisp and deep introduction. Thank you.
Okay.